it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh.
Happy holidays from all of us at Musings on Golf. Well, on behalf of my dear friend Janice Self, I am Kelly Elbin, extending warm wishes to all of you who have taken the time to enjoy the great storytelling that we've offered to you through our show in 2025. It has been a remarkable year in terms of our lineup of guests. And after the our main interview with a gentleman by the name of Duke Butler, I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Duke Butler is our guest today. And Duke Butler, while you may not necessarily know that name right away, after you hear the interview that I recorded with Duke a couple of weeks ago, you will really enjoy someone who I think is one of the really good storytellers in golf. Duke was the tournament director for the Houston Open from 1978 to 1991. Was involved in the business of the PGA Tour for almost 40 years. Duke knows a lot of people. Duke is someone who has a lot of thoughts about the game and a lot of terrific stories. You're going to hear a lot about Jack Nicklaus, particularly early on. There's a certain day that in the life of Duke Butler that for him meant more than anything else when it came to where he was going to be headed in his life. I'm necessarily one who can remember a lot of dates. I know the dates of my kids' birthdays and things like that, but Duke Butler is one of those guys. He can remember the exact date and year when, you know, certain moments happened to him that helped shape his life. And I really enjoyed talking with Duke. He has very strong thoughts and ideas of how to make the Ryder Cup better. And, you know, he also hints a little bit at where the PGA Tour is headed, certainly starting in 2027 under the guidance of new CEO Brian Rolapp. And are you ever going to see a very different PGA Tour starting in 27, even as opposed to what you'll see in 2026? Just as a hint, the Sony Open that you'll see in January in Hawaii, don't anticipate seeing any more PGA Tour events in Hawaii starting in 2027. And don't anticipate the PGA Tour starting before the Super Bowl starting in 2027. Very interesting individual, Duke Butler. Lots of really great stories. Enjoy them. A few things I have to offer on the flip side of that, but enjoy that. And again, so happy to welcome one of our new corporate partners, the Friars Golf Club, and you'll hear a spot from them coming up, along with our other two great corporate partners in William and Harry and Titleist. And right after that, you'll hear from Duke Butler. America, this is your moment. Liam and Harry's limited edition spirit shoe is here so every fan can feel like part Team USA from the first tee to the final putt. Two head-turning designs, premium deerskin, 100% waterproof with spikeless grip and all-day comfort. Limited run, don't sit this one out. Pre-buy now at williamandharry.com. Get into spirit. Get into comfort. Is your golf life stuck in a bunker of country club hassles? Tired of the wait lists and the six-figure initiation fees? Well, at the Friars Golf Club, we take care of all of the hard work. Planning exclusive trips and unforgettable rounds on top-rated courses, so all you have to do is show up, have fun, and make lifelong friendships on the first tee, the 19th hole, and far beyond. Our terrific 2026 lineup includes international destinations like Dubai and Scandinavia, plus top domestic resorts such as Sand Valley and Black Desert, and access to some great private clubs. Join the Friars Golf Club today. Email us at info@thefriars.com, the word musings in the subject line, to receive a $500 trip credit when you join. We invite you to stop dreaming and start living the ultimate golf experience with the Friars Golf Club.
Your most important shot is the one you're about to hit. And whether it's the first drive of the day, a difficult approach from a tight lie, or a bunker shot to save par, you need to know your golf ball will perform exactly the way you need it to. Superior performance on every type of shot. It's why the majority of the world's best players choose the Pro V1 or Pro V1X, and why you should too.
For 40 years, our special guest today was intimately involved in the business operations of the PGA Tour, with 14 of those years dedicated to running the Houston Open. He earned his PGA of America membership while working at a major championship venue and for a U.S. Open champion. He played in 28 PGA Tour events, has been honored nationally by the PGA of America, and is a very proud member of the Texas Golf Hall of Fame. Oh, the stories will be flowing from him today, and they will include what he is also doing to help the next generation of golfers. We're looking back and we're looking ahead, and it's an honor to welcome my friend Duke Butler to Musings on Golf. Duke, great to talk to you again. How are you?
Thank you, Kelly. Thanks for having me on. I've enjoyed knowing you for a long time and knowing of your father. Your father was one of the people I most admired in the world of professional golf.
Well, I appreciate that. And, you know, when we do these interviews, I always get feedback before the interview from whoever the guest is, but you were very expansive in your comments, and it was terrific. And you mentioned that at one point, Duke, you were kind of looking to maybe go down the road of a club professional, kind of like what my father, Max Elvin, did at Bernie Tree Club for many, many years. But there's many ways, Duke, to have a great run in the game of golf, as you proved, right?
Yes. Well, growing up in Texas, my mentor, Henry Ransom, who had won 5 PGA Tour tournaments, well, actually, they were PGA tournaments, as you know, through 1968.
Yeah.
And 2 4 ball championships. Well, Henry Ransom, who was also my college coach at Texas A&M, he said, you got the right personality, you're a hardworking guy, but you might not quite have the game to play successfully on tour. So I suggest you try to become a club professional at a private club in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, or Michigan, so you can work 8.5 months and go to the Sun Belt in the winter and play and enjoy the family. And so I did aspire to become a club professional at a private club and be good enough to occasionally play on tour when the tournaments were in the region. And I was fortunate to, after graduating from Texas A&M, to get a job at Baltusrol Golf Club under the great Johnny Farrell, the 1928 U.S. Open champion.
Yeah, and from that, opportunities arose, and you took advantage of them, certainly with, I mentioned about your longtime involvement with both the Houston Golf Association, the Houston Open, then what became the Shell Houston Open. But let's go back a little bit. Duke, I think it's fair to say that most of us in the course of our lives, we remember certain moments, certain dates that they stand out, they help shape who we are, what we've done. For you, Duke Butler, yeah, the date of April 23rd, 1962 is easily the most memorable day for you from a professional standpoint. Why? What happened that day?
I was an eighth grader growing up in College Station, Texas, and my junior high team left early morning to go play in a tournament at Brock Park on the north side of Houston. And I played well and shot a 79. And that Monday, there was an 18-hole playoff at Memorial Park for the Houston Classic title. And the competitors were Bobby Nichols, Dan Sykes, and a heralded rookie who hadn't done much on tour yet by the name of Jack W. Nicklaus. So we asked our coach to take us to watch the last few holes of the playoff, and the competitors were on 16 when we got there. And Bobby and Dan shot 71, and Jack shot 76. And Bobby and Dan went down the par 5 first hole, a 91st hole, and Bobby Nichols made an eagle to win the championship. And Dan Sykes had about a 14-footer for birdie, but he didn't get to putt it. And I just thought it was fantastic. And riding home that day, my coach, B.B. Holland's Nash Rambler, I decided this was so much fun today. I'm going to dedicate my life to the business of golf. And I never wavered. I've always enjoyed it. Greatest sport in the world.
Was it that so compelled you to sort of set your life's course that day after seeing that? Was it the intensity of the action, watching them play? What was it, Duke, that struck you so much?
It was everything. It probably was a gallery of about 5,000 watching them, admiring those players. It was my hero, Bobby Nichols, class of 57 at Texas A&M, winning. It was the heralded rookie who had won two U.S. amateur championships and wanting to get an insight into Jack's game. Years later, I learned there was a real quirk that happened in the final round at Memorial, and I got to know Jack. And around 1990, we were promoting the tour championship at East Lake in Atlanta, and a month prior, and Jack came to be a speaker. And next morning, there was a shotgun start at 9 o'clock, and he didn't participate. He looked at me and said, "Why don't you grab a couple of your buddies and let's go to breakfast in the clubhouse?" And so, for the first time, I mentioned that I had watched him almost win his first tournament. And he said, "You were there at Memorial Park?" And I said, "Yes, I was." And he asked, "Do you know why I didn't win?" I said, "Yeah, you shot 76 on Monday." And he said, "Well, that's true, but you know the long par three on the front nine? It's almost a dogleg left, number 6 or 7? I said, "Yeah, 7. So he said, "On Sunday, it was playing about 235, and I had to hit a 2-iron, and I needed to hit a draw, which I didn't do very well. He faded most of his shots. But he snuck it onto the front right of the green, 35 feet from the hole, and his caddy was attending the flagstick, a Mr. Ford, and Jack struck his putt, and Mr. Ford couldn't get the flagstick out of the hole. And he panicked and jerked up the flagstick, and the cup liner came up above the surface, and Jack's ball in motion struck the cup liner and bounced a foot away. So they asked for a ruling, and I believe it was tournament director Joe Black who provided the ruling, pretty harsh, 2-shot penalty. So Jack tapped in for 5 instead of the 2 he thought he deserved. And that's why he was in the playoff. And so at that point, I knew him well enough to kid him a little bit. And I said, "Well, that's probably the luckiest thing that ever happened in your life, other than meeting and marrying Barbara Bash, for you won the 62 U.S. Open at Oakmont in Arnold Palmer's backyard for your first victory, instead of it being the Houston Classic." So we've always had a big chuckle about that.
Well, that's a great story. And when you and I played earlier this month at the Palm Beach Par 3 with our good friends Dennis Walters and Phil Stambaugh, you told me about a few of those stories. You also mentioned about Jack and Barbara's involvement, you helping them get involved with Honda Classic here at PGA National Resort and Spa. And Duke, that really turned that whole event around, along with a guy named Ken Kennerly, who infused all the everything into it to make it the event that it became.
Well, before commenting on that, I would just like to say a couple of other incidents that occurred with the great Jack Nicklaus. On May 28th, 1977, I had Monday qualified for the Atlanta Classic, and I had the same 36-hole score as Jack, 143. And DeWitt Weaver and Jack and I teed off on Saturday, and I had not met him. John Montgomery Sr., introduced us on the putting green. And when Jack heard me introduced off the tee as being from College Station, Texas, he started needling me right away about being an Aggie and Texas A&M sports. And what he was doing was trying to make me feel more comfortable. He knew I was nervous playing with the greatest of all time. And that didn't work out too well. I was nervous the whole round. And as I sometimes say, we shot the same numbers that day. He had 67 and I had 76. And but it started a friendship. He went out of his way to make me feel comfortable, and shaking hands off the 54th green, he said, "Well, we'll play again. I enjoyed meeting you." And just a couple other things. And then I became tournament director of the Houston Open. And he played in the 1986 Houston Open just after winning possibly the greatest Masters of all time when he came back. And this 86 Masters or the 97 Masters when Tiger won for the first time, those were highlights. And then with my career evolving, working for PGA Tour, I was tournament director of the rules and competition for his memorial tournament, 92 through 95. And we had a lot of experience with thunderstorms and rain. And so it evolved that I began working for the PGA Tour in 92 under Commissioner Beaman, one of the great leaders of golf. And he retired in 94, and Commissioner Tim Fincham took over. So regarding your story about the Honda Classic, and this is something I really enjoyed, but about a month after the 2005 Honda Classic, we were seated in an executive committee meeting in tour headquarters in Ponte Vedra Beach, and Commissioner Fincham asked the 10 of us at the table, "Who can improve the Honda Classic?" And I said, "Well, I can." He said, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "Well, it was playing at Mirasol, a little windswept. Mirasol's a great place." But I said, "I suggest we move it to PGA National and we get Jack and Barbara Nicklaus to be the host organization and hire Ken Kennerly as tournament director." And he said, "Good. How long is that going to take you?" I said, "About 6 months." So it only took 3 months. I went to see on one trip the Lloyd Ecclestone, the owner of PGA National, Canadian. He founded the great facility in 1971, I believe. And the same day, Ken and I went to see Barbara and Gary Nicklaus and ask them if their children's hospital would like to be the host organization. That meeting lasted about 5 minutes. He said, "Sure, we'll be delighted. I'll tell Jack tonight. We're taking over."
And Duke, it really transformed that event that had been, you know, it's in my backyard here, and it had been an okay PGA Tour event into one that really drew terrific fields and an incredible community event.
Yes. Well, Honda was a terrific sponsor starting in 82 until just recently, but the tournament played at a different site every 4 years and didn't quite have the community support, but Ken and his contacts through the Palm Beach area elevated the stature of the tournament. And many of the players live in the Palm Beach County area, and they all began supporting it. Rory played, Tiger played, DJ, all the top players played, and it grew into great stature. And it still is a prominent tournament right now with Cognizant as a sponsor. But there are so many good tournaments before and after the Riviera tournament, which Tiger hosts, and the Bay Hill tournament, which Arnold hosted for years. Those are before and after. And so it doesn't quite get the professional feel that it desires, but the tournament has performed well. And PGA National has been a great site since 2007.
Well, we're so pleased to be joined by Duke Butler, a member of the Texas Golf Hall of Fame and the tournament director of the Houston Open from 1978 to 1991. Duke, before we sort of get into those years with the Houston Open, I mentioned that you played in a number of PGA Tour events. You played 28 PGA Tour events in the mid-70s, and you did all of them while working at Baltusrol, and you did all of them through Monday qualifiers. Is that correct?
That's mostly correct. Only the top 60 were exempt, and there'd be another 25 or so who had won tournaments, so there were only about 85 exempt players. So on a given Monday, there might be 60 to 80 of us playing for 20 spots. Often we hadn't been allowed to play the course in advance and we'd be playing somewhat blind although I would trespass and go out and march off the course best I could at dusk the previous evening.
Yeah.
And I did play in 50 Monday qualifyings over a three-year period while I was working at Ballast Roll and Echo Lake. And I was successful 22 times. 6 times I made the cut, which got me into the next tournament at the time. But I wanted to get that itch to play out of my system. And I was able to do so. And except for a few four putts and rainouts, I enjoyed it.
I think that's a heck of a percentage, the 22 out of 50. That's, you know, Jen is self, our executive producer, and I, we talk about, you know, different individuals in the golf industry who might make for interesting guests on Musings on Golf, you know, in addition to elite players. Being a tournament director is a huge responsibility. You took over at, I believe, the youngest in PGA Tour history at age 29 when you were named to run the Houston Open. How did that come to be in terms of getting that responsibility at a relatively young age?
I appreciate that question, Kelly. And following my senior year in high school, I applied for and interviewed for a scholarship from Houston Golf Association, which was their primary charity endeavor. And I was awarded a scholarship to attend the state university of my choice in Texas. And of course, I chose Texas A&M, where my father had worked.
Yeah.
And, but I'd attend the Houston Open every year, and I would see the gentleman who interviewed me, and I'd sometimes write a letter and provide an update. So when their executive director position became open in late 1977, one of those board of directors encouraged me to apply. And I thought, well, that's kind of an inside administrative job promoting a tournament. And I was on my path to be a club pro at a private course. And so along with my father, who was chairman of my board, they said, why don't you interview and see how it goes? So in 2 interviews, on January 5th of 1978, I got offered the job to run the Houston Open and the local junior program and some amateur tournaments. And I accepted, and my father said, well, you can do that for 3 years and you can always return to being a club pro if you want. But the tournament at the Woodlands was going to begin in only 100 days. So I really had to put my head down and go to work and try to meet everybody. And the great Gary Player, one of your recent guests,
yes, sir,
won the Masters and Tournament of Champions the 2 weeks prior to the Houston Open. And he came in there with a lot of national publicity. And not only, he was there by himself, and not only did he win, he had positive things to say in the interview room every day. And, you know, he's one of the people I've most admired in life. And that was a springboard for me. And I ended up spending my life promoting the game on the tournament director and administrative side. A lot of it was due to the impetus of Gary Player getting off to a great start.
Well, right. That was your very first Houston Open that you ran in 78. And then Duke, in the course of life, funny things, strange things happened. Talk a little bit about the 1 year that the Houston Open was essentially canceled, but the very good from a business standpoint that came out of that.
I think you're referring to the 91 Houston Open, when Monday through Wednesday went just fine, all the pro-ams, and Thursday morning at 8 o'clock, it started raining, cats and dogs, at a rate of about an inch an hour. And it's continued to rain all the way until about 1 o'clock on Saturday. There was no way we could play Thursday, Friday, or Saturday. And the tour from their lofty branch in Ponte Vedra White House ordered us to play 36 holes on Sunday on 2 different Woodlands courses and call that a championship. Well, the Masters was the next week, and there were 34 players in the Masters entered in our field. One of them, Seve Ballesteros, and Seve had phoned me on Saturday from his room at the Woodlands, and he had Jose Maria Olazabal within earshot. And he was calling to let me know that if the rumor is true that you're planning to play 36 holes on Sunday on a wet, muddy golf course, we're not going to play Masters next week, and we don't want to get fatigued. So I summoned three of the four player directors, Peter Jacobson, Mike Donald, and Roger Maltby, and we called Commissioner Beaman and said, you know, your staff is ordering us to play 36 holes on Sunday, but it won't work, and the Pensacola Open has discontinued, and there's a late October date available. Could we please reschedule for October 22 to 28? And Commissioner Beaman agreed to that, and we had a very successful tournament. But on Sunday, we staged a scramble. The independent insurance agents were in the last year of their five-year agreement, and 33 players agreed to play just an exhibition on Sunday, and they played by school affiliation or country affiliation. We had all these great University of Houston players, and Steve Elkington, Billy Ray Brown, Blaine McAllister. And they played a threesome against the North Carolina boys and the Wake Forest boys and the French. And it was just fantastic. And that day, a gentleman from Shell Oil handed his card to a volunteer and asked to please pass along the card to me. And his name is Bill Schutzenhofer. So I phoned him on Monday, and he said, I understand you're looking for a successor sponsor. Could you come talk to me about it on Wednesday at One Shell Plaza? Well, of course, I wasn't late for that.
No.
And Mr. Schutzenhofer asked how much money we needed, and it would average about $5 million for 4 years. And he said, you got it, but you can't.
Ow.
On the spot, he said, you can't tell anybody. We're going to have to negotiate for 5 months while you take me to play golf once a month. And sure enough, the Mulligan tournament, as we called it, in October, Shell Oil was announced as new sponsor, and they stayed 26 years. The best thing that ever happened to the Houston Open was getting rained out.
What a great story. You're officially retired as of 2015, so it's been 10 years now. But
I don't like that word.
I know you don't. You're a very active man, and I imaged in one other piece of the responsibility. As a tournament director, whether you or Ken Kennerly when he was running the Honda Classic, Duke Butler, how do you go about trying to secure the top players to play in your event on an ongoing basis? Can you give maybe an anecdote, a story that kind of gives a sense of kind of what you have to do to get X player to play?
Well, I tried a personal touch. I was a part-time player. I knew many of the top players, and we tried to make small improvements. When I played my 20 minutes on tour, you'd go to the driving range and have to pay $5 for 30 practice balls. So I said, we're going to have free range balls. We're going to have free food. We're going to get to know every player by name, whether they're a top player or a Monday qualifier. Get to know their family a little bit. Paul Issinger started on tour pulling a trailer behind him. He pulled into the Woodlands. This guy from Florida with a strong grip. And I thought, well, he's only going to be out here a year. And pull his trailer. And well, we got to know him. Turned out he was pretty good, had a lot of personality. So I would visit about five other tournaments each year, three from January through the late April Houston Open, and two following, usually the Nelson and Colonial. And I'd often be there on Tuesday or Wednesday when the players were receptive to talking. And the really marquee players would be in the Wednesday Pro-Am. So I'd go out as far away from the clubhouse as I could and meet Payne Stewart on the 14th hole or something, and I'd get to know them. They'd have, after they hit their tee shot Pro-Am, they're probably tired of talking to the amateurs, so they'd talk to me for 5 minutes. And when Payne got to be really good, I started worrying about him continuing to play in the Houston Open, which he had done continuously since 83. But he won the 91 U.S. Open and the 89 PGA Championship. And so at the Phoenix Open in 91, during the Pro-Am, I went out to talk to Payne. And he was friendly, as he always was. And I said, well, I sure hope you'll be playing in Houston. He grabbed my shirt sleeve. He said, are you out here recruiting me? And I said, yes, I want you to play. He said, I'll be there always. Don't be worrying about it.
Yeah.
And it's just an example of the loyalty the players have. And I can't say enough good things about John Mahaffey and Peter Jacobson, who were allies of the Houston Open, and they would help us recruit the players. Roger Maltby, same way. Mike Donald was on the policy board, and his best friend was Fred Couples. And
well, that good word of mouth is at that level. You can't pay for that otherwise, right?
I think that's true.
Really enjoying our conversation with Duke Butler here on Musings on Golf. So I won't use that R word anymore, but I do know you keep a very close eye on what's going on in golf today, and you have some very strong feelings. I want you to start, Duke Butler, with the Ryder Cup. It was the most interesting, if you will, Ryder Cup at Bethpage. How would you improve the Ryder Cup as it is today and going forward? How would it look different under Duke Butler's?
Kelly, you know, I'm a fan of all golf, and when Gary was on with you a month or so ago, he was very critical of the Ryder Cup at Bethpage, and a lot of people have been. And I think there were gaps, and I have written the PGA of America. I have a friend, Russ Libby, who's among the 13-member board of PGA of America, and I know some of the other board members, but I did send an email letter on some points that could be improved. First, I don't think it's good to sell 50,000 tickets for a 24-player event on Friday and Saturday. Only 16 players play in the doubleheader, and allow those 50,000 patrons to drink and purchase alcohol all day from 6:30 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. They're going to get rowdy. Yeah. And that's what happened at Bethpage. I think that was preventable. So that's an easy one. And I'm sure that will be better at Adair Manor and Hazeltine when we host in America in 29. I would do some other things. I liked the old system of 10 players off points and two selected by the captain. I thought Keegan Bradley did an excellent job representing America as captain, and Luke Donald as a prince, and he's a stellar captain. He might be captain again. But I think the PGA is a little too concerned about how much money they can make on the Ryder Cup. You know, they get a lot of money from media rights, and then the tent and skybox and television sponsors and 50,000 tickets. I think it's too much emphasis on the net gain. I believe also the player in the envelope is such an antiquated system, needs to get looked at. When Victor Hovland wasn't able to play in the Sunday singles, his team, European team, was awarded a half point and U.S. half point. Well, with the U.S. rally on Sunday for an hour or so, it looked like that half point was going to be the difference in the Ryder Cup. And I found that to be absurd because, you know, I'm a big Jacksonville Jaguars fan. And, you know, when one of our best receivers, Brian Thomas, was out for a few games, we asked the opponent to just play 10 players on defense.
And it didn't happen.
It didn't happen.
No.
So what happens is a substitute goes in.
Yeah.
And I think a substitute in the Ryder Cup is so easily done. An assistant captain could be at the ready. Mm-hmm. The Europeans had Alex Noren as an assistant captain. He had just won the BMW championship 2 weeks prior.
Yeah.
America had Gary Woodland and Brant Snedeker. We had capable players who could have filled in if they had been notified in advance to St. Louis and the on-deck circle. I think that's the most easily resolved matter. Have a substitute ready. And then I believe the captains should alternate their selections. It's not like a baseball game where you insert a lineup card of 9 players for one team and 9 for the other and then mesh them and go play. I don't like that. I think the captain should use his cranium and say, okay, Captain America, your first choice, and who are you going to send out? Scottie Scheffler. All right, Captain Europe, who are you going to match against him, et cetera. Match them. It did work out well for NBC that Scottie played Rory on Sunday.
Yeah.
But that supposedly was by coincidence, and I think the captains should match head-to-head. And then I have one that I think all of those are fairly easily approved, but I think the format is outdated. The PGA got rid of match play in 1958 for its championship. And I believe on Sunday, the competitors should play stroke play match play so that everybody plays 18 holes, just like you and I are playing, Kelly, and you're 3 under playing the 18th hole, and I'm even, but you know, you might be nervous and make a triple bogey, and I might make a birdie. The big swings. And there are four great reasons why the Ryder Cup should play stroke play in the singles matches. One is a televised finish. You know, when the Rome Ryder Cup was played 2 years ago, the cup was determined an hour and a half before the scheduled airtime. I know Tommy Roy, producer for NBC, wasn't happy about that, and neither were we, the viewing audience. We clicked over to the NFL. And the changes in the stature of the match, you know, there can be birdie versus double bogey. Significantly, the buyers want to watch the parade go by, all 18 holes. And you got the ticket buyers, the skybox sponsors, the carpet buyers, they want to watch all the matches go through the 18th hole, and they deservedly so. And lastly, I don't like this in sports, and you and I discussed it a little bit, but the gallery gets so involved in all sports, and when there's an upset, they want to rush the field or rush the court. It'd be much safer for the athletes to be able to play through the 18th hole, go through security, and then do their interviews. And I think the rowdy crowd at Bethpage might have been worse if the Americans had been leading. So I've addressed that with the PGA of America, and I think it's unlikely that they'll change to stroke play matches on Sunday, but it has been done in other competitions, such as the Dunhill Cup and Shell's Wonderful World of Golf, so there is precedent.
And you would take it to 4 days instead of three, correct?
I think 4 days allows better television, better for us at home, more flexibility for weather delays. You know, I hear from PGA, well, that's not traditional, but the most traditional professional sport is possibly baseball. And they made changes going to the clock and runner on base and extra innings, and it's better for it. So,
Duke, certainly the pitch clock, in my opinion, has helped baseball immensely. It was the slowness of the game was hurting it. I want to, before we get to our final couple questions, you had emailed me as well, and you said, I'm keeping an interested eye on the future of the PGA Tour under new CEO Brian Rolapp. And Duke, there are going to be some major changes to this tour. The tour that we've known and kind of come, you know, accustomed to for a long, long time. Can you give maybe a 40,000 foot view of what we might expect the tour to look like starting in 2027?
I can, prefacing by stating that nobody is more on the outside than a former insider. So these remarks are just from reading the tea leaves. Mm-hmm. I understand that CEO Brian Rolapp is very smart, and he's charged by SSG to bring new blood. And his theme is simplicity, parity, and scarcity. Well, scarcity worries me, because scarcity means shortened schedule, weeks off after majors. Mm-hmm. Start the season after the Super Bowl, things of that nature.
Right.
25 tournaments of equal stature, probably the same prize money. And so weeks off and scarcity concerns me that it might just be an opportunity for Liv to play in America or play around the world.
Yep, I agree.
And it does concern me. And fewer players, you know, 100 exempt players, and these signature events with 72 players. You know, how do we discover the next Ben Griffin? It's very difficult for them to break through. We just hosted PGA Tour and Korn Ferry qualifying here in Ponte Vedra Beach last week, and five players got their card and 40 others got exempt. But I'm always interested in who the next star is going to be. And so I love it when Lee Trevino from yesteryear or Ben Griffin today breaks through. And I don't think professional golf should be all about the television ratings. The television contracts are through 2030, so there'll have to be some contractual adjustments if these changes are made and implemented for the 27 season. But the host organizations are really the backbone of the PGA Tour. They get the site, they're assigned a date, the players are made eligible. But the host organization has to do liaison with the title sponsor, sell all the tickets, get 1,500 to 2,000 volunteers, and try to derive a net for charity after paying out prize money of 10 to 20 million.
Yeah.
And I'm a little worried that the new regime doesn't use the word charity very often. And Commissioner Beaman strived beginning 1980 or so after he had begun commissioner, being commissioner in 74. He strived pretty much for equal purse and equal charity. And I thought that was a fantastic formula.
Yeah, and I concur with you on it. It'll be a very different look starting in 2027. I'm not sure that you'll ever see another tour event in Hawaii, certainly to start the year. It'll start after the Super Bowl. And the word scarcity, it does scare me a little bit as well. You mentioned about the next Ben Griffin, and I know you're working with a lot of youngsters in the Jacksonville area to try to develop Luke Butler, the next generation of maybe they're club professionals. Maybe they're just golfers for a lifetime. It really matters to you, the love you have for the game, right?
Yeah, well, I grew up with junior golf, and I was charged with improving the junior golf program in Houston. One time we got to where we had 1,400 players, and we had simultaneous tours, those north of Interstate 10 and south of Interstate 10. So in retirement, I do volunteer to help two categories of players, the underserved community at the public courses around Jacksonville, and then those players who want to earn a college scholarship or play on teams. So, I volunteer for Moormeyer's Children's Fund, and I go out to Brentwood every Saturday morning. Sometimes we practice at the University of North Florida, and I instruct and try to inspire players who wouldn't likely get introduced to golf, or they couldn't quite afford the greatest game. And I don't know if I'm helping them or they're helping me, because they are so nice to me and so appreciative of the little things you do for them. And last year, six youngsters who started at Brentwood won scholarships to historically black and college universities, HBCUs.
That's great.
One of them had swung a golf club before I met them. Five of the others, I watched them take their first swing. And they're all playing college golf right now. And then our daughter was a good high school player, and I taught her along the way. It sometimes took her to the great Jack Lumpkin at Sea Island, but some of the other girls caught on that I like to teach, and I am the best teacher in town for the money because I don't charge anything.
Exactly. Hey, I want to ask you to close. I want to ask you about your favorite foursome, but I know you're very much involved with the Jacksonville Area Golf Association, your family championship.
Yes.
That's a big deal. You put that on each December. That's a big deal with a lot of people, a lot of fun, a lot of great memories, right, Duke?
Yes, I've been volunteering for JAGA, Jacksonville Area Golf Association, since retirement in 2015. I was recently reelected president, and we host 12 tournaments a year, and we award scholarships. So our 501c3 arm, JAGA Trust, awarded 23 scholarships to deserving high school seniors, And we have 61 youngsters in college on scholarship right now. And my favorite day of the year is coming up this Saturday. Each Saturday prior to Christmas, we host something called the Family Championship, where two relatives play together in a scramble, short cords, par 58. Most of them dress in holiday attire. And we play fast play and just have a lot of fun. And I wish I'd coined this phrase, but Kirk Triplett taught it to me one day. Golf is an acronym. Great opportunity, lifetime friends.
Yeah.
And I believe that's what you and I have lived by all of our lives.
No question about it. And it continues to this day. I get to have the great pleasure of closing each of these episodes of Musings on Golf, asking about a kind of a dream foursome of people you would play a round of golf with, three others, whether they're still with us or deceased. I think you have a favorite personal foursome, Duke Butler. And you also told me you have a historic
family. I'd like to comment on each.
Yeah.
My wife, Sheila, played on the team at Princeton. She's very good. She just retired from PGA Tour 31 years, running all the big events for the commissioner, the hospitality. And my son, Duke IV, is an outstanding player, played at the University of Florida. And daughter, Sadie, played high school golf and is a very good player. And she won the Jacksonville City Junior Championship. So I would be the fourth-ranked player in that group. My historical great foursome played together on January 15th, 1967 on the Texas A&M course, Walk and Carry. The significance of that date and playing with my father, Coach Henry Ransom, and Travis Bryan Jr. is that date was the first Super Bowl.
Wow.
Green Bay and Kansas City. And we ignored that because we thought it was a corny name and it was played in Pasadena, California, and we'd finish playing, we'd be able to watch the second half. So I missed the first half of the Pasadena, California Super Bowl in 1967, but I haven't missed a play since. And I believe the Jaguars are going to be in the Super Bowl this year, Kelly.
I believe they are red hot. You don't have the Kansas City Chiefs to worry about, at least for the 2025 season, but you do have the Houston Texans to worry about and a few others. Hey, Duke, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you for your time. Thank you for, frankly, what you've done for golf for a long time. And as I said, you continue to do through the underserved kids that you're helping. I mean, my goodness, to send kids off to play golf at scholarship at universities is fantastic. I know that Family Championship means so much to you. And the stories, you know, from, heck, man, we covered from Jack all the way to Jack's Beach. And this has been a real treat. I'm glad we could do this, dude.
But I add just a little trivia. You know, you and I think a little bit alike. And Titleist is one of your great sponsors. And that 1986 Masters, Jack owned the McGregor Company. But through the great Joe Ternesa, he asked to play with a Titleist in the 1986 Masters. And he played and won with a Titleist 5. And Scotty uses high-numbered Titleist 5 through 8, if you watch closely. So I've had a lot of loyalty and fondness for the Titleist company through the years, and I'm so pleased that they're one of your supporters.
Well, so are we. I appreciate that very much. Duke Butler, what a treat. Merry Christmas, happy holidays, and all the best for you and your family for 2026 as we move forward into the world of golf. Duke, thanks again.
Thank you, Janice and Kelly.
Our friends at William & Harry are always looking for ways to stand out in the crowd. So for anyone who belongs to a country club, William & Harry can have your shoes private labeled to fit your specific needs. The same applies to your company or any organization you might be affiliated with. This makes you a clear winner. Why? Well, you have a better quality shoe that feels great, and you have the logo of your club, company, or organization on your shoes that really makes you stand out on the golf course. To learn more, visit williamandharry.com today and be sure to input our promotional code 15OFF, M-O-G, for a 15% discount at williamandharry.com.
Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X are the best performing, most consistent in the game. So how does the best get better? You start by listening to the best players in the world. You experiment, iterate, validate. You trust the best process to create the best golf ball the game has ever known. The all-new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. More speed off the tee. More control with your irons. More spin with your wedges. And more opportunity to shoot your lowest scores.
Duke Butler, I enjoyed spending time with him. Particularly at the end, Duke, as he noted, has been, quote, retired for the last 10 years, but not really. And Duke is someone who's very active in the Jacksonville Beach community. And as he noted, the family championship that they played last weekend at Jack's Beach, a country club. But beyond that, the number of kids that he's influencing, teaching kids, particularly those who want to, underserved kids who want to play collegiate golf. And man, that's, to me, that's the sign of a great human being is what he's doing. It isn't about what he accomplished in his 40 years with the PGA Tour. It's trying to help that next generation of kids who may not have the opportunities that some of us have, but who really love the game and really want to play the game. And to have a mentor, somebody like Duke Butler to guide them, can mean everything to them. I noted at the outset the lineup of guests we've had, this is our final live episode of 2025. We're going to have Dr. Bob Rotella with an encore performance next week. And for good reason, Dr. Rotella was easily our most listened to episode of 2025. But man, did we have some other incredible guests. Jack Nicklaus on the week of the Ryder Cup. Gary Player just a couple of days before he turned 90. And if Gary Player's energy doesn't get you pumped up, it's hard to imagine anybody who can. That Lee Trevino on early in the year, Lee and I go back a long way, had the great fortune of caddying for him in the Ryder Cup. And through my dad, Max Elbin, he and Lee were very good friends. I've stayed in touch with Lee over the years. It's been great. Having Cameron Young on, Cameron who represented the U.S. on the Ryder Cup team this year, I thought Cameron was an excellent interview, along with his dad, David. Had David on shortly before the Ryder Cup. David, a longtime PGA professional, and really David, really Cameron's lone teacher. Dave Marr we had on. David Marr III, the son of Dave Marr, the 1965 PGA champion, and just a great storyteller, Dave. Bones McKay, Rich Beam, Rich Lerner. I think of Rich Lerner and the stories that he told about working for his dad and the driving range that his dad owned in Pennsylvania. And I really enjoyed that time with Rich. And that's one of the fun things that's been for me is to, you know, guys who I know a little bit and spending even a half hour with them in an interview and learning so much more about their lives and through the stories they tell. Larry Nelson, having Larry on, always felt bad that Larry obviously won the PGA Championship twice, won the U.S. Open twice. But he was snubbed by the PGA of America, was never the Ryder Cup captain. But Larry's, I thought it was a really good interview. Corey Connors, Corey, terrific player, along with Tom Fazio, the great golf course designer. And we started the year with Luke Donald. And I thought maybe that ended up being the proper omen in a good way for Captain Donald as the Europeans once again prevailed in victory at the Ryder Cup. But Dr. Bob Rotella, certainly, as I mentioned, next week is someone you're really going to want to listen to. But it's also mixed emotions. And, we lost Bob Bupka in July. And I think about Bob a lot. And he and Janice were together for many, many years. And Janice has continued on and it does such a wonderful job as our executive producer. And I think any time you're at the holiday season and you've been with someone for so long, through the ups and downs and the memories that you have, and then you don't have that person anymore. It's hard. And I know that's a void for Janice, personally, very much so. It's a void for me, both personally and professionally. And I think of Bob at the holiday season. I know he loved Christmas, and that's tough for his family, who won't be able to see him. I know that Janice is going to be headed out to see family members out in Colorado. She's in for a long voyage, a 2-day car voyage, but she'll make it out there just fine, and she'll have fun with family. But Bob, know that you're always with us, and I truly believe Bob's spirit is with us as well. We close 2025. I remember Bob Bupka well. I love the man, and as much as we had great guests in 2025, it was a great honor for me to have been part of Musings on Golf, led by Bob Bupka, and I was along for the ride, and I'm going to continue on, and Janice and I will continue on with great guests in 2026. So as we close, again, happy holidays to all of you. Thank you for making Musings on Golf part of your life. Thank you for all the kind remarks that you've given to me about the show. Thank you for all the nice things that you said about Bob on his passing, and look forward to a great 2026 with many more great stories on Musings on Golf.